Meeting of the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order. And we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2120. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2120, as you recall, we had a work group get together and work on compressing and streamlining the comprehensive planning process that's currently in statute. They were back last week and spoke to the Dash Fives, but there were still a couple of concerns, and they met and came to an agreement on what is before us as the Dash Six amendments. The Dash Six amendment do similar things as the Fives, but there are some few changes. It details the community plan needs to include strengths, goals, priorities, and strategies. It also, as from the beginning, changes the ages to read 0 through 18 years of age, has an effective date of January 1, 2005, has an emergency clause effective July 1, 2003. All of the stakeholders have had the amendment, and I believe that there is consensus on this. And there's some folks in the audience if the committee has any questions.
I'd like to have the three main parties come up and speak to how we love this bill now. So we do love this bill, right? Kind of, sort of.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Fultz, Association of Oregon Counties. We did meet over the last week, did come to consensus, and the major issues, I just want to share those quickly with you. The behavioral health plan that we had wanted to have in a separate piece of legislation, the decision there was to have that done administratively, and we OMAS is planning to do that as far as we know, so that's the plan for that piece of it. Doesn't need a separate bill. This bill clarifies what is the community plan and what are service plans, and it makes clear that the service plans are approved, in this case, the public health and mental health plan, by the Department of Human Services, not by the State Commission on Children and Families. It also clarifies for us that there's no additional work from public health or mental health in order to do this. We are just referencing the plan as part of the community plan, and that's a big issue for us because we were concerned that it would take time away from our other services. So those are the main issues, and we believe that this bill resolves those, and thank you for allowing us the time to do so.
Donna.
For the record, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. We, too, have been a partner in reviewing and helping to write amendments to 2120. We have always supported the opportunity to work together with public health and mental health, and this legislation just codifies that relationship, and we believe that it will strengthen the community comprehensive plan to have both public health and mental health participate. And we have no problem with the Dash 6 amendment. We had no intention of approving anybody else's plans anyway, and so quite frankly, this just makes sure that that doesn't happen, which is fine with us. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Jenna.
Thank you. I don't know if I have much to add with what has been said, simply that the approval portions that you see starting on page 7 of the Dash 6 amendment more closely align the statute with the process that the agencies came up with throughout the Senate Bill 555 process. You might note, if you were comparing the Dash 5 to the Dash 6, that there are several sections missing about approvals of service plans. That's because when we got out the books and looked, those were already in statute elsewhere, and so we took all of those out. So essentially this just delineates what the State Commission portion of the service plan approvals is, and then codifies the joint approval process that the agencies go through for the community plan.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you all very much. I'm going to assume nobody's going to come up and oppose this, so I'd entertain a motion on the dash six.
Mr. Chair, I move dash six amendments to House Bill 2120.
Representative Tomei moves the dash six amendment to House Bill 2120. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash six amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Representative Anderson.
Yes, did we ever get a reading on the fiscal impact here? We had Will this go two ways and means?
It doesn't.
It does not, but since we've kind of addressed on the real concern was fiscal impact on the county level, and that's been taken care of. So it does not need to go to Ways and Means.
Okay.
So, any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Do we want this on consent?
Good idea.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2120 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2120, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Close the work session on House Bill 2120 and open work session on House Bill 2165. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2165 is requiring under certain organizations to report information concerning conduct of physicians to the Board of Medical Examiners. It requires licensees to self-report certain conduct to the board. What we have before us are the dash three amendments. The dash three amendments specify and refer that the healthcare facility is referenced as defined in statute. It also defines what an official action, incident, or event is. It changes all physician language to licensees. It also specifies the self-reporting timeline of 10 working days and a healthcare facility reporting timeline of 10 business days. It also contains language that if a person is reporting in good faith, is immune from any civil liability, and we do have the parties in the audience to speak to the amendments if the committee has any questions.
Are there any questions? Does anybody feel a compelling need on this? Okay. Then I would entertain a motion on the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that all parties are in agreement with this.
Yes, otherwise they'd be storming up to the front, I
Great.
Think. So.
Mr. Chair, I move dash three amendments to House Bill 2165.
Representative Tomei moves the dash three amendment to House Bill 2165. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash three amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2165 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2165 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. How about this one?
Consent calendar, it sounds good
okay.
to me.
Okay. I'm trying to keep these four sessions short. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2165 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And House Bill 2165, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2165. House Bill 2251, we do not have the amendment. So we will roll that one over till Wednesday because we should have an amendment by, 5 o'clock today, something like
Hopefully.
That? Hopefully. So if that's the case, we should certainly have it by Wednesday. So, so I will open a work session on House Bill 2609. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2609 prohibits the Department of Human Services from limiting prescription drugs used for clinical conditions resulting from mental health, HIV, AIDS, and cancer, modifies requirements for the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have, per our conversation of last week on the 18th, there was a bit of discussion on language contained on page 3, lines 11, about clinically superior drugs. The dash 1 amendments deletes that language, and then we also have a dash 2 amendments that is inserting under clinical conditions the word nausea. And the folks kind of want to...
Okay. Jim Gardner, Bruce Goldberg, and Marcia Keith, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Pharma. The dash ones, which are our amendments, basically delete the sentence that reads as follows on page 3, lines 11 and 12. Only those drugs evaluated as clinically superior within a particular therapeutic class may be included on the plan. And that is intended to... address the primary concern that was identified both in the letter from the governor's office and in the letter in the testimony of Tom Holt on behalf of the Pharmacists Association. The net effect of that is to permit the inclusion on the preferred drug list of drugs which are judged to be equally clinically effective on an evidentiary basis. So whether they be generics or non-generics, if they're determined to be of equal clinical effectiveness, they can all go on the list, and then a drug would not be excluded simply because it was not clinically superior. The effect of the remaining language, however, is important but more subtle. And that is to require for a drug to be placed on the list that there must be evidence of its relative clinical effectiveness, and that absence of evidence cannot suffice for evidence. It's kind of a burden of proof issue. And what we're really doing here is codifying not only making more clear what was implicit in the legislative intent of Senate Bill 819, but actually codifying the evidentiary standard that the Health Resources Commission itself articulated. And if I may, Mr. Chair, just really briefly go through that process. Originally, the Health Resources Commission, when it embarked upon this task under the leadership of Frank Baumeister, had an evidentiary standard which it called the null hypothesis. And that was that if there's no evidence at all about relative clinical effectiveness, we're going to presume that they're all the same. And then the kind of scientist types on that commission kind of looked at that and scratched their heads and said, you know, that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If there's an absence of evidence, there's no evidence, you can't reach a conclusion one way or another about the relative clinical effectiveness. So the net effect of this amendment with the deletion of the line that we're proposing to delete is to require that there be at least an affirmative evidentiary determination that, let's say, they're all the same, all these drugs are equally effective in a class, rather than the commission simply throwing up its hands and saying there's no evidence and therefore we presume they're all the same. So it's a subtle, we think, but important distinction, and one which actually echoes the determination of the Health Resources Commission itself. So with that, let me pause.
Okay, Bruce?
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator for the Office of Health Policy. Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, real briefly, In reading through the bill, this bill as written would forbid the use of price to select among equally effective drugs. If drugs are found to be equally effective, it seems to me prudent for the state to be able to choose the more cost-effective. You know, at a time when we are dropping people from coverage and dollars are in short supply, this seems to be at odds with efforts to be cautious and responsible with our use of public dollars. I think this bill would be greatly enhanced by actually striking lines 13 through 17 on page 3. Jim and I have disagreements about the language in there. It seems to me that if there is indeed no evidence of any difference between drugs, then those drugs are indeed the same, can be considered the same until we find some evidence. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith. I'm here today representing Merck Company, and we have a Dash 2 amendment to ask you to consider. It would, in two places on the bill, insert the word nausea after pain on page 1, line 29, and on page 2, line 34. It seems to us that it was an oversight to not have nausea in there in the first place, since it is an attendant condition at about the same level as pain and infection to the diseases that are listed. So we would respectfully request that nausea be added as a condition as well.
Okay. Any questions? Jim.
Mr. Chair, I do, if I could just respond briefly to one thing that that Dr. Goldberg mentioned. The language on lines 15 through 17 is specifically intended to allow price and cost to be used as a comparison once drugs are found to be affirmatively found to be equally effective. It says simply that you can't do that comparison solely on the basis of cost and until and unless you've made an evaluation of their relative clinical effectiveness. So let's say you've done the evidence-based evaluation of the relative clinical effectiveness of drugs in a specific class, and you have concluded on the basis of the evidence that they're all pretty much the same, an affirmative conclusion, they're all pretty much the same. At that point, you can certainly use cost as a basis, and I just want to clarify that for the legislative purposes of legislative history. And again, the notion that you can't use lack of evidence as a basis for inferring that they're all the same, that's not my idea. That was the evidentiary standard articulated by the Health Resources Commission under Dr. Baumeister, and all we're doing here is codifying it.
I guess the question I have to whoever, and going back last session to Senate Bill 819, I mean, we're talking about mental health, HIV, AIDS, and cancer drugs, which, as I remember, in 819 were kind of excluded from everything else anyway. So I'm not quite sure what the angst with this bill is. I mean, yeah, Bruce.
Can I respond? Thank you, Chair Cruz. The issue that I have isn't really about the mental health HIV piece. The language about the absence of evidence really refers to all other drugs, not to HIV, cancer, and mental health drugs. So that's really the issue.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Bruce, then, how could this be changed to address your concerns?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, I think to delete Section 4B would certainly address my concerns.
If that all of B were gone?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
We're heading more toward fully capitated plans and managed care plans. Won't that give you the control over cost problems and yet allow the physician, if there's a specific drug to that's going to hit that condition the best, be able to use it in certain circumstances?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, you know, indeed, the fully capitated health plans have actually had more freedom to manage the drugs than the state has. The healthcare marketplace is, to say the least, dynamic, and what exists today in the healthcare marketplace may not exist a year or two or three from now, and so therefore, to me, it's just most prudent to allow the state the kind of management tools it needs to be certain we can get medicines to those citizens who need it.
Bruce, I guess, and I understand that, but quite simply put, without sub B, doesn't that give the state the ability to say we aren't going to do research on this, and then since we don't have any evidence that there's a difference in these drugs, that allows us to say what is available strictly on price, right?
Chair Cruz, actually, it has the state review the evidence and review it carefully. I think the issue here is that oftentimes there is a lot of evidence about drugs. There aren't the kinds of head-to-head comparisons that this bill would call for. And there is a lot of evidence, and it would allow the state to continue to review the evidence.
Well, I guess, you know, in light of all of the discussion that went around last session on Senate Bill 819 and all of the things that were put on the record, both on the Senate side and on the House side, as to the fact that nothing in that bill was designed in any way, shape, or form to restrict the physician's ability to prescribe whatever he wanted. And then in light of, in the last month or so, what OMAP and the governor's office have been saying about we aren't getting the savings we thought we were going to do, so we're going to go to PA and we're going to force the savings, which goes completely against legislative intent. And this is, in my opinion, this takes us back on track of what everybody said we were doing 2 years ago, and now the administration has decided by executive fiat to disregard. So, I mean, isn't that kind of the issue here?
Chair Cruz, I, you know, with all due respect, I actually think they're different issues. I understand the issue around prior authorization, and I do believe it's a different issue. That the issue here is more about what can be considered evidence of differences in clinical effectiveness. In essence, what this bill is saying is that if you have a group of drugs and there's no evidence for or against any differences in them, mm-hmm. you've got to actually include all of them in a formulary or on a preferred drug list. I shouldn't have used the formulary word. I have bad habits go away slowly. But I think the issue is that if there isn't any evidence, that it would make it so that those we'd have to consider all of those drugs equally effective. And I think in clinical medicine, what we do know is that in many of these studies, you can infer that indeed many of these drugs may certainly be the same. They also may not be. But I think we need to be able to use some management tools in the absence of evidence, because that evidence may take years and years and years to get.
Well, that may be true, but 819 wasn't about management. It was about information, and it was about trying to set up a system so physicians would have most recent best available information so that they could make choices. And so it would seem to me under that criteria, if you have no evidence to say that one's better than the other, all those drugs should be listed and let the physicians make his choice based on cost rather than saying, since there's no evidence that X is better than Y, we're just going to include X because it's cheaper, and we're not going to put Y even on the list. I mean, I'm having trouble understanding how where things are going fit with legislative intent.
Representative Kruger, I actually agree with exactly what you just said. You said that if there's no evidence that physicians should be allowed to just use cost as a determinant, and I think that's exactly what we're saying that the state should be allowed to do, is really the same thing. If there is no evidence, then we should make that decision based on cost, because that's the one real piece of evidence that you have in the lack of any other evidence.
But 819 said the physician will make that determination, not the state, and so that's where we have gone beyond intent, I think. Reps or Jim.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to pass out something if I may, I wasn't intending to do this unless this issue came up, and this has to do with the issue of legislative intent. This is the memorandum that Senator Minnis provided to the Leadership Commission on Healthcare Costs and Trends, and on the second page of it, you will see his explicit statement that, in fact, lack of evidence is not equivalent to evidence. That was his statement of what the legislative intent was in Senate Bill 819. And I want to say again, I think for the third time, and I apologize for being repetitive, this distinction between whether or not you can infer equal effectiveness on the basis of lack of evidence or not, it's not my idea. This was this evidentiary standard that was articulated by the Health Resources Commission itself, which is a part of Bruce's office, or an advisory group to Bruce's office under the leadership of Frank Baumeister. They looked specifically at the question of what do you do when there's a lack of evidence. And at first they said, we're going to do what we call the null hypothesis, and that says if there's no evidence, then the burden of proof says we're going to presume they're all the same. And the scientist type said, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so we're going to change that evidentiary standard and say if there's a lack of evidence, we can't reach a conclusion one way or another about the relative clinical effectiveness. And that's really all this bill is doing, is essentially codifying and articulating that evidentiary standard.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carter, in your opinion, is there evidence in the classifications that are presently being used? And if not, how long will it take to get up to speed and get evidence-based information on each of the different ones?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's an excellent question. In some of the drug classifications, drug categories, there clearly is evidence about relative clinical efficacy. The statin class, for instance, they did reach a clear conclusion that a couple of those drugs are clinically more effective than the others. And in the other drug categories, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I think that it is certainly within the realm of possibility for a number of these classes that the same thing could happen that happened in the statins, particularly as you have this ongoing review process. This is not a static process. They look at these things every 6 months or so and kind of search the literature. Evidence-based practice center at OHSU, which is one of the best in the country, helps them. So, they're continually on the lookout for new studies that do compare, the relative clinical effectiveness. And my sense is that those studies are on the increase.
Are we working ourselves kind of into a hole in terms of the evidence is more than likely going to point to the new hybrid-type drugs as being more effective but also greatly more costly?
What's
the balance here?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's another excellent question. You can't come up with a sort of one-size-fits-all answer to that. There are some studies, for instance, that actually say that some of the older NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, are just as good as the other ones. So if that's a scientific study, it ought to be considered and its results taken seriously. In other cases, a clear example would be, say, Gleevec, which is a brand new category of treatment for cancer. There's nothing like it in the world, and an objective study would say that one's the best, but you just have to go kind of class by class.
Thank you.
I agree with Jim on all that. It's always good to have some things we can agree on.
Any other questions?
I have a question, Marcia. Thank you. Marcia, I'm somewhat perplexed why you were adding nausea. I mean, it seems as the issues that we're looking at, HIV, AIDS, cancer, and mental illness, are in a classification almost by themselves, and nausea seems to be a much less severe issue. I'm concerned why you're adding nausea, why you'd like to add nausea to this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that pain and infection are side effects of treatments for those four or three actual categories, and nausea is also a side effect of those treatments. And it just seems to me that it was an oversight and it just got overlooked and left out. That certainly the chemo treatments for cancer, for example, create far more nausea than they do either pain or infection. And it just seems that nausea should be in there with pain and infection.
Thank you.
Representative Westland.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we can worship the Holy Grail of 819 and say what legislative intent was, and I appreciate that. But where does this stop? I mean, you can say that bed sores are, it can just keep going. And, I mean, I was involved in the craft unit 819, and you carried it on the floor. So I have concerns over expanding this list in this controversial area. I hopefully will be able to stand behind Representative Anderson's remarks that by the time this is all said and done, this won't be much of an issue because there won't be very many fee-for-service patients. But I don't understand how, after we've come this far, all of a sudden here's an inclusion of a new category of drug. I mean, I understand your point. I don't disagree with it. But for what it's worth.
New category of drug, what do you mean?
Well, you've got clinical illness resulting from mental illness, HIV, AIDS, and cancer,
mm-hmm.
including pain and infection. I understand that. Well, now let's just start listing all kinds of other, drugs or categories of condition that would require drugs.
Well, Representative Westland, I'd say that these are very specific categories, and which we've dealt with in your committee to a degree when we're talking about carve-outs. These are some of the areas that we're talking about carve-outs.
I understand. So. That's exactly my point.
I agree with you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. So you're not committee will stand at ease. reconvene the committee. We're still in work session. Representative Westland.
Representative Westland moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2609.
Representative Westland moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2609. Is there any discussion? Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I just wanted to get on the record the position of the Pharmacist Association before I vote on this bill.
Tom, you're okay with the dash one?
Okay, thank you.
Good enough? Okay. Any other discussion? Are there any objections to the dash one amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Tomei objects. So noted. The dash one amendments are adopted. Representative Westland.
I move House Bill 2609 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Westland moves House Bill 2609 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be voting against this bill. I know when Senate Bill 819 was passed, we were in dire straits fiscally in our state. We are in even worse shape now, and I think anything that would require us to put more money into drugs and cut out services to medically needy is not a good way for our state to go. So I will be voting no again on this bill.
All right. Yeah. Representative Westland, would you like to amend your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would amend my motion to say that I move House Bill 2609 as amended by the dash one amendments to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Westland amends his motion that House Bill 2609 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That was what I meant.
I know that's exactly what you meant. Any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Barker.
Yes.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative Montaigne.
Excused.
No.
Representative Weston. Aye.
All right, House Bill 2609, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2609 and open a work session on House Bill 2828. Martin and Taylor and J.L. Wilson, please. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. Morning, Chair.
How was your weekend?
Not nearly long enough.
Okay. Please.
Representative Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm bringing House Bill 2828 back to you. This is a bill chief sponsored by Representative Tim Canope and Senator Kate Brown. This is a bill that would allow nurse practitioners to operate as primary care providers under the workers' compensation system, depending on which iteration of amendments, for a set period of time. The dash fours are 90 days and 90 days. 90 days would be the period of time in which they could see a patient before needing to re-refer that patient to a physician. Existing law gives nurse practitioners 30 days or 12 visits. The reason, and I want to review everything that went on in your previous public hearing on this bill, but briefly, the reason for this bill is that this bill identifies nurse practitioners as having a lesser role as primary care providers than physicians who are unrestricted under the workers' comp system, and it's one of the few remaining places in law where that distinction is made. It is disruptive to patient care to have a primary care provider you're familiar with have to refer you off after 30 days or 12 visits. Nurse practitioners are typically a lower cost provider, which ought to be a benefit to the workers' compensation system. And frequently in rural areas, nurse practitioners are the sole prior practitioner in a community, so this can also mean that a patient has to be referred to another community. And finally, there is an issue of some nurse practitioners losing patients unnecessarily. That's not a competency issue. It's simply an issue of a system that goes back about 15 years that identifies nurse practitioners in a way that's not consistent with their practice. That is to say, they're identified as a lower practitioner within an existing scope. The dash amendments that you have are 2, 3, and 4. They represent a lot of work on this bill. Dash 2 was a compromise attempting to get a full vote out of MLAC on the business side. We ran into a road... Yes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. I don't have the 2s or the 3s. All I have are the dash 4s.
Okay. So the brief reference to 2s or 3s are our 2s were attempting to get a full consensus on MLAC, which was not achieved. 3s represented our ideal, which was 120 days. And the dash 4s represent what Representative Canope wants us to land on, which is the original understanding that he had with some of the folks on the business side of MLAC, which brought 2 yes votes for Mr. Wilson and Mrs. Buttrick. Unfortunately, MLAC, we didn't receive the full... Sorry, I said Buttrick. I meant Trestle. I saw Jay. I'll give him a look. I was doing fine right up until then. I get names.
I have been okay with it, too.
Yes, I'm sure you would. As you're familiar, the process of these bills typically goes through MLAC. It's a 10-member committee, 5 from business, 5 from labor. We achieved 5 votes on the labor side and 2 of the 5 on the business side. Lacking the full 5 votes, we didn't get the support of MLAC. So we're back here before you to throw this problem your direction. I would say that the major concession in the bill, other than having a fewer number of days than our nurse practitioners had originally hoped for, was they also are not going to be able to rate permanent disability. Those are the changes that the Dash 4 represent, and we're willing to accept those changes despite the fact they were made in a process to get MLAC, which we didn't ultimately achieve.
JL.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson. Before you today is the co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I just want to be clear about MLAC's role with regard to workers' comp legislation. A 10-member committee, as Martin said, 5 members from business, 5 members representing labor. I'm the chair of the business side. Mr. Shiprack, Bob Shiprack, is my co-chair on the labor side. The rules require that... 3 votes from both management and labor suffice to give MLAC's approval of a workers' comp bill, on which House Bill 2828 has typically fallen under the purview of what we look at. A motion was made to recommend House Bill 2828. It failed. It failed by virtue of the fact of not achieving the requisite amount of support from the management side. I will say that this is the second time. I think we're walking down a slippery slope here, to be honest. This is the second time that a bill has passed that MLAC did not support. The first time, just to prove that it happens, you know, what's fair is fair, and the other shoe drops, on the business committee passed a bill that was supported by management but not supported by labor, and we have to oppose that too. MLAC's been in process since the 1990 Mahonia-Hall agreements in order to lend some sanity to workers' comp, under the premise that a workers' comp system as it existed 12 years ago could hollow out your business community pretty fast, because you were talking about benefit levels that were probably the worst in the nation, rates for employers that were in the top 5 or 6 highest in the country. And I really, when you look back at what occurred in 1990 with the 1990 reforms, it probably has to rate as one of the biggest legislative success stories of all time, because we've gone 13 years now with not one single year of a rate increase on workers' comp, a pure premium rate increase, and you've gone with ever-increasing levels of benefits, which gets the confidence of both sides. MLAC recognizes that the 2 major players in the system are business and labor, and that we're the 2 parties that have to be happy with the system and have to have confidence in the system. That's the value of Management Labor Advisory Committee. It really keeps political warfare from happening over workers' comp bills. Which brings us back to 2820. This is kind of thin ice here, because although I supported the nurses in the MLAC process, I've got to keep the MLAC process intact, or keep the integrity intact. And that is to say, what you're doing with 2828 essentially overturns one component of the 1990 reforms. And the reason that's important is because you may say yes to the nurses this time, and it may be understandable. But the same arguments that Martin gave you are the same ones that the chiropractors or any other alternative provider will give you 2 and 4 years from now. And then once it's decided that MLAC has no bearing, well, there are a lot of other peripheral players who want back into the process who might have been excluded under the 1990 reforms, who say, you know, why go through MLAC? We can go straight through this process. So I would just tell you that you know, it's your prerogative to do what you want to do. But as somebody who, you know, as somebody who's appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, as someone who's supposed to take a look and validate workers' comp bills to make sure they're consistent with the 1990 reforms and gain the trust of both labor and business, you know, this stuff gets pretty sketchy. So I am before you in my official capacity as MLAC co-chair and in a position of opposition to 2828. And I'm happy to answer any questions. I really want to be more, you know, very forthright about where we're coming from or the process or anything like that.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. JL, I'm still having a hard time understanding what the opposition is to that. I understand that MLAC doesn't like it, but it's unclear to me why.
Okay. It didn't garner the necessary support on the management side.
Right.
The five members of the management side, two lobbyists, you have me and Lisa Trussell, and you have three actual comp practitioners, one who works for CNF, one who works for Hoffman Construction, and another for NORPAC. They're the actual people on the ground doing comp claims. They, quite frankly, were not comfortable with going back from what was essentially the 1990 agreements. And that it's really as simple as that, Representative Tomei. They wanted to keep the integrity of those 1990 agreements intact, and they weren't comfortable moving forward from there at this time.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Wilson, just to clarify that for me, the objection is not the practitioner themselves. The objection is bringing this process outside of the MLAC process. Is that what it is?
Thank you, Chair Cruz and Representative Dalto. I wouldn't care. You have every right to do what you want to do. All I'm saying is you have to recognize that this does go back on the 1990 reforms, which is sacred in terms of what's happened to workers' comp since those reforms, and that's problematic from the management side, and so that's the crux of my objection. Plus, another thing that I you should think about, like I mentioned, another piece of the 1990 reforms was that chiropractors, instead of having an attending physician status, had the same 12 treatment 30-day limitation that's placed on nurses. I would expect, if 2828 passes, and like I say, that's your prerogative, but how are you then going to draw the line on chiropractors when they come back and ask for the same thing? How are you going to draw the line on any alternative provider who wants to be covered under workers' comp? Once you've said yes to the initial group, that is a slippery slope of which the first step is being taken with 2828. Whether you want to go outside the MLAC process, fine. If you want to dissolve the MLAC process, fine. But all I'm saying is the MLAC process was implemented as part of the 1990 reforms to basically safeguard those reforms and make sure that any subsequent reform or alteration to the workers' comp system had both the majority support of the business and labor community as represented on the MLAC committee.
Any other questions?
Yes.
The Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So help me understand then, was it everybody on MLAC or just the five business representatives that opposed this?
Thank you. It was opposed by a majority of the business representatives, not all five. I supported the nurses, as did Lisa Trussell. The 90-day treatment and time loss agreement was something that I said I could be okay with. But I am in a position now where I stand up for the committee as a whole because the rules say it requires three support on both sides. And like I say, this is not exclusive to the nurses because the business community passed a bill.
Did you have the support of the labor side?
Yes, that is true. The labor side.
The total support on the management side, is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'd just like to state for the record, I have some of the same concerns that Mr. Wilson just expressed. However, things being what they are, I would entertain a motion on the Dash 4 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2828. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
I can understand the concerns of the 1990 reforms. However, I guess I don't hold them sacred. I think there are times when we have to change things, and certainly things are different in 2003 than they were in 1990. We're looking, because health care has become so expensive, we're looking at ways to decrease the expense, and it seems to me this might be one of the ways, so I don't have any problem with it.
Any other discussion? Any objections to the Dash 4 amendments? Seeing none, Dash 4 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2828 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2828 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state that the objections raised by MLAC have not fallen on deaf ears, but I'm still going to support this bill.
Well, and I, for the record, this slippery slope scares me to a large degree. There's Oregon is not the most business-friendly state in virtually any context you want to look at. However, our workers' comp system is very business-friendly, and I do have a fear that we're setting up a scenario where there'll be a feeding frenzy next session. I hope that does not happen. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the concern I have is that a nurse practitioner is not an orthopedic surgeon, is not a subspecialist of medicine in the sense that many of the subspecialties are. And it seems to me that it would be wise to keep that 30 days, not extend it, because at the end of 30 days, a nurse practitioner should know pretty well where this treatment is going. If it needs to go out, if it's a neck problem or a different areas of medical care, that probably ought to be referred out anyway. So I'm not sure that I don't have the statistics on how many cases need to go 90 days or need to go 60 days, but it seems to me that within 30 days we probably could have a pretty good indication of what the long-range treatment is going to be, and therefore I will vote no.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused. Cruz votes aye. House Bill 2828 having received the constitutional majority is declared passed. Who would like to carry it?
I would be willing to, but I would imagine that Representative Monis Anderson might be the better carrier. So can you assign it to me, and then if she decides to take it, we can...
Okay, I will assign it to her, and if she doesn't want it, then we can come back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Monis Anderson will carry, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2828. And open a work session on House Bill 3574. No, well, let's just tell where we are on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3574, as you recall, is directing the Oregon Telecommunication Coordinating Council to collaborate with healthcare education providers and healthcare industry to develop a plan that utilizes existing resources in the expansion of current efforts to provide health care education throughout the state, creates a task force. It specifies the task force membership to be appointed by the governor, directs the task force to report to the interim committee, provides and that they provide a report to the 73rd Legislative Assembly. It sunsets on January 2nd, 2006, declares an emergency effective July 1. This amendment before us, the Dash 2, removes what the Dash 1s had for staffing requirements. The sponsors of the bill are hoping to rescind this Ways and Means referral. Thus, we have a Dash 2 amendment that basically outlines the task force in the fashion I just described, as well as it deletes the language that the Economic Development, the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, and the Association of Oregon County shall provide staff. Also puts out puts the repeal date from 2004 to 2006. But due to the lack of time that fiscal had to evaluate this amendment, we do not have a fiscal impact. Thus, we don't clearly have information before us to rescind the Ways and Means referral.
And with that, we have waited this long. I suppose we could wait a little longer. So that's the status as of right now. We will not move the bill without what we need to move the bill one way or the other. So I'll close the work session on 3574, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 878. Yeah, I'm taking this one out of order because we have some folks that came from quite a distance to testify on this. I want to make sure they have the opportunity. So, Modesto, and you have others with you or just you?
I'm the only one representing. I'm trying, but I haven't.
Okay. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am Modesto Jimenez. I'm representing the Klamath Tribes. Having spent 15 years in tribal government, currently serving on the Klamath Tribal Council. In addition, I serve on the Tribal Budget Committee and serve on tribal health issues on our Resource Committee and on the CADA Board of Directors, which serves all of Klamath County. I thank you for your time and ask you your vote to send Senate Bill 878 to the floor of the House. I can tell you that it is currently very painful having to scale down our staffing and services as a result of Oregon Health Plan cuts. Since we all related as tribal members, when I have to deny medical treatment to a tribal member, I'm turning my back on my own family. Thank you for your attention and assistance. I also have a letter from a written testimony from our health general manager, Harold Rodney Clark. I believe he sent you all a copy of that. So I was wondering if you wanted me to read that testimony or if you all had that. I have copies of it.
I think we have copies.
We have a copy.
Okay. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge, the Acting Assistant Administrator of OMAP in the Department of Human Services. The department supports this bill. This is a bill that would allow the Native Americans who would, by eligibility, fall into the OHP standard eligibility group to receive the more comprehensive OHP Plus benefits package. And that can be done at basically no cost to the state budget because of the fact that 100% federal funds would fund this benefit package. So we see this as a win for everyone, and we support the bill.
And correcting a slight mistake that was made earlier. So any questions? Representative Anderson.
I'm just interested. with the numerous benefits coming from the various casinos that the tribal councils have, what percentage of Native Americans are not covered or would be eligible for Oregon Health Plan only? Seem to be fairly small.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, the population of Native Americans on the Oregon Health Plan is about 10,000 currently, and about 2,900 of those are in the OHP standard benefit package. They meet the income and eligibility qualifications for OHP standard.
Any other questions?
Well, just to follow up.
Representative Anderson.
Is that because certain tribes have casinos and others do not, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question, but I would assume so, yes, that not all Native Americans have incomes over the federal poverty level, and that may be higher in some tribes than others. I'm not entirely aware of what that income distribution is.
And I would also point out that employment at a casino is not restricted to tribal members. It's my casino, Seven Feathers. They employ folks from the community, and it's they're not exclusive in what they do, and so clearly there are many tribal members who are not employed in that activity. Does that make sense?
No, because I think aren't the tribal benefits shared with all in the tribe? This is not the forum, I guess, unless we're to bring back one of the.
I think every tribe has a different set of arrangements they've made as to how the income from those ventures are distributed. So it'd be different depending on which tribe you're talking to. Any other questions?
Well, just comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Westland.
Based on the 100% federal match for Native Americans, I'm looking for my companion bill here declaring all Oregonians as Native Americans, and I don't see that. What happened?
Well, obviously you dropped the ball.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. Vernie and Jackie, would you mind coming up together? Okay. Good morning. Please, go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 878. I am Brene Berner, the administrative officer at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. The board employs 55 staff at its Portland, Oregon office on the campus of the Portland State University in support of health promotion and disease prevention activities for our 43 member tribes. This includes all 9 Oregon tribes and all of the federally recognized tribes of Idaho and Washington. Oregon tribes are supporting this legislation after a series of discussions at meetings over the past 5 months. The first meeting on January 7, 2003, was at our offices where tribes first suggested the idea that is contained in this legislation. On February 19, 2003, representatives from Oregon Indian Health Programs and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs met at the Quarterly Department of Human Services meeting to discuss ways to mitigate the impact of Medicaid cuts on our programs and the tribal members they serve. Subsequent meetings with the Department of Human Services and at the Oregon Commission on Indian Services, attended by tribal chairs, solidified tribal support for the concept. Since the change proposed in this bill will not increase the state's spending and will result in savings for Indian health programs in Oregon, we think it deserves the support of state legislatures. As you know, the federal government reimburses the state of Oregon for the health care costs of American Indians and Alaskan Natives at 100% the federal medical assistance percentage. Based on meetings with the Oregon tribes and the testimony of Grand Ronde Tribes Chair Cheryl Kennedy, Coquille Tribal Health Director Eric Medcalf. We are confident in saying that Oregon tribes support this legislation. The Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board recommends passage of this bill as an important step in improving the health care status of Oregon's Indian population.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Mercer. I'm the executive director of the Native American Rehabilitation Association. We operate an Indian health care organization located primarily in Portland, Oregon area. Last year, we treated people from 257 different tribes and bands. These are people who are residents of Oregon. A quarter of the people that we serve were from Oregon tribes, but the tribal members represent, these are people who are enrolled members of tribes and live in Oregon and have been residents here. 50% of the children in Portland area live in poverty. The health disparities are issues that really plague our nations, and we have talked quite a bit about it here and in other forums about the nature of the severe health disparities. So we welcome the opportunity to talk to you today and ask for your support. We've been working closely with the Indian Health Board and the tribes in the development of this this bill. So thank you very much.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I heard the numbers correctly. Did you say 25% of the people that you serve are within Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, 25% of the people are from Oregon tribes, but there are people from other tribes all over the country who live in Oregon and are residents of Oregon. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 878, open the work session on House Bill 878, or Senate Bill 878, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 878 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 878 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Barker. Aye.
Senator Dalton.
Excused. Excused.
Senator
Tomei.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 878 to the consent calendar.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 878 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 878, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 878. Thank you all very much. Good piece of work and a nice catch. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 74. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 74 is exempting from statute, which is a current requirement for insurance coverage of certain metabolic disorders from the automatic repeal provision. It declares an emergency effective July 3, 2003. Yes, and it moved off the Senate floor 27-0 with three excused legislative business.
Okay, we'll call up Senator Courtney and Tim and Katie Kelsch. And Senator, if you could help me out with something, this PKU, could you pronounce that word for me?
Chair Cruz and members of the House Health and Human Services Committee. I cannot.
Henceforth, PKU, right?
Correct.
Please go ahead.
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, Representative Dalton, Representative Tomei, Representative Barker, Representative Westland. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem, 97303. And I'm a state senator, and my Senate district is number 11, which includes parts of Salem, and it runs up through Brooks, Jervis, and Woodburn. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 74. This bill would continue the requirement that insurance companies cover treatment for PKU and other inherited metabolic diseases. PKU is an inherited disease which prevents an individual's body from breaking down phenylalanine, a common part of most foods that we eat. I butchered that word. The excess accumulates in the blood and begins to damage the brain. If the blood levels of this substance remain too long, the damage to the developing brain is severe and irreversible. I will stop there because there are experts here to brief you on the details and answer your questions on this particular disease. However, I would like to tell you how I became aware of the issue. Some 6 years ago, my then constituents, Tim and Cheryl Kelch of Kaiser, first brought this problem to my attention. In a few moments, you will meet them. They're up here with me, along with their daughter, Katie, who was the impetus for the bill back in the 1997 session. Katie has PKU. The original measure passed because of Katie and because of the hard work of several families from across the state. In the 1997 legislative session, we were successful in passing legislation that required coverage for the various rare metabolic disorders, which includes PKU. The bill before you simply extends that coverage. There was a sunset placed on that measure which came out of the 97 session. This bill would extend that sunset. I will just add that there are a few families affected by this and other metabolic diseases, and that the impact of the insurance industry is minimal. I ask that you give special attention to the families and medical experts on the issues, some of whom have traveled many miles to have taken time to be here today to discuss this measure. That is my official testimony, members of the committee, and I believe you had that same committee in written form before you.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, please.
Sure. Chairman Cruz and fellow members of the committee, my name is Tim Kelch. I am Katie's father. My wife and I and Katie and her brother live at 1370 Rappel Street in Kaiser. And I'm here today to try and gain your support for Senate Bill 74. We've provided you with a copy of the testimony, and so that I'm not redundant, I think I'll just do this basically without reading the script. When Katie was born, fortunately, she was tested very quickly. One of the standard blood tests given to all children born in Oregon, and the fact that she had PKU was discovered. The folks at OHSU got together with us within 3 days. We got to work on the dietary requirements necessary to control the condition and went forward from there. In 1995, my wife, her company, rather, was acquired by a larger and different company. On the advice of OHSU, we contacted their medical provider to make sure that PKU would be covered, and they verbally said yes, no problem. At that time, most of the major carriers in Oregon provided coverage for PKU. It wasn't a big deal. After a few months, we noticed that our claims were not being paid. We contacted them. They subsequently said they had no record of their commitment to covering the condition. And that began a ordeal of roughly 9 to 10 months of appeals, faxes, letters, and so forth. It took us nearly a year and three appeals to finally get them to cover Katie's condition. As I said earlier, most of the major providers in Oregon do cover PKU, and it just wasn't an issue. But unfortunately, there are a few providers out there that don't see things the same way. In fact, they actually said that, in their opinion, it wasn't medically necessary. We had letters from physicians and from OHSU that contradicted that in very strong terms. The PKU issue is one that we've worked hard on starting back in the 1997 session. We were successful at that time. The legislation did pass both the House and the Senate unanimously. I don't know if that's happened before. Obviously, it's not a very common thing, but a lot of people clearly feel that it's the right thing to do. So we'd just like to ask again for your support for Senate Bill 74 to continue the insurance coverage for children born with PKU and other related metabolic disorders. As you can see, Katie is a very, very normal and beautiful 10-year-old. Without the medical coverage, that would be, you know, potentially much, much different. I would like to add that the insurance coverage, or rather the legislation, is not a cure-all. In our particular case, we have a $500 per member deductible on an annual basis, and then the insurance covers approximately 80% of the remainder. So it still costs us about $300 a month out of pocket just for her medical foods and formula. In addition, I'd like to point out that as a female, it's critical that she remain on the diet and keep her Phe levels at a manageable level. If she were to become pregnant and if her Phe levels were too high, then the baby would become retarded in utero. Clearly, that's not anything that any of us want to have happen. So staying on the diet and keeping those Phe levels within the recommended range is just critical, especially for a girl. Thank you very much.
Katie. Chairman Cruz and committee members, my name is Katie Kelch. I'm 10 years old and I PKU. I'm here to ask you to support the renewal of the medical foods law, also known as Senate Bill 74. Oregon has a law that requires that all babies be tested for PKU at birth. As a result of that law, I was diagnosed and placed on a very strict diet and special formula that saved my life. If I was left undiagnosed and untreated, I would today be very retarded, unable to attend school or do anything a normal 10-year-old can do. It would cost insurance companies or the state of Oregon a whole lot more to take care of me like that than to cover my medical foods and formulas that make me healthy today. When I was little, most insurance companies covered the special formula that I needed, but one day back in 1995, when my mom changed jobs, her new company didn't. That's one reason why we asked you to pass the law in 1997. Today, because the law expired, I asked you to pass this law. Have any of you ever had to be on a strict diet? It's not very fun, is it? My strict diet is required for life. My strict diet requires that I never eat meat, cheese, or dairy of any kind. That means when my friends are eating cheeseburgers, ice cream, and pizza, I'm eating vegetables and salads. Activity is as simple as slumber parties, birthday parties, and school field trips require that I carefully pre-plan what I will be able to eat. My parents send a blood test to the state medical laboratory every other week to make sure that I'm managing my diet properly. I'll be honest, managing this diet is very difficult. I don't know how I could stick to it if I didn't at least have a couple of medical food choices that I could eat with my formula. Did you know that more than 30 states have passed laws that require insurance companies to cover the cost of medical foods that treat PKU? Please help me and other people like me to stay on this difficult diet by passing Senate Bill 74. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Any questions? Very well done.
Yes, I have questions.
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Katie, so what is it that you can eat, and what is the formula that you take?
Well, the formula, there's like three different kinds you can have. I have vanilla, and some of the foods I usually eat is fruits and salads, and sometimes I have chips, and not very much because they have too much protein sometimes.
May I follow up? Mm-hmm. So, Katie, how do you get your protein?
That's from the formula that I drink every day. I have to make it.
You have to make it yourself? And what do you put in it?
There's this little powdery stuff that we get from OHSU.
Uh-huh.
And you mix it with hot and cold water, and there you go.
Yes.
Katie, will you be on this diet all the rest of your life?
Yeah.
Well, I commend you, not just for your testimony today, which was remarkable, but also I know how difficult it must be for you to pass up other kinds of foods, and I commend you for strictly staying in your diet.
Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Katie, are your friends very supportive of your sort of dietary needs?
Yes, they are. When I spend the night, they make sure I eat the right foods as well as I do.
Do they always have a lot of questions about what you can eat?
Yeah, usually.
They don't tease you about eating cheeseburgers?
Mm-hmm.
No? Okay. Just curious.
Any other questions? Representative Westland.
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. My wife's sister, back before the advent of the simple test, had PKU and suffered some of the consequences and has been institutionalized ever since. And so, A, Katie, you are very lucky to live in this age of the medical technologies and availabilities that we have. You did a great job testifying, and I want to thank you and your father and you, Senator, for bringing this bill forward, this very noble bill. It's excellent public policy and something I think that is what makes the legislature. Thank you for being able to do this for us.
Thank you.
Yes. Chairman Cruz and Rep. Westland, I'd just like to add, too, in addition to your comment, I don't know the exact cutoff date, but prior to the advent of dietary controls and restrictions, every child born in the state of Oregon with PKU became severely retarded and, as a result, most likely institutionalized, places like Fairview, et cetera. So, you know, you fully understand, I think, what the consequences of non-treatment are. It's severe.
Right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Mike and Gary and Kathleen.
Where's that Carrie?
I don't know much.
Could be Carrie.
Carrie already. Oh. We have a PowerPoint. All right.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. I'm Mike Skeels. I'm the director of the State Public Health Laboratory in the Department of Human Services. There's nothing I can say that will improve upon what Katie just said, so I'll be very succinct. Our department supports Senate Bill 74 because it's vital that children with these metabolic disorders continue to receive adequate treatment, because if they don't, they get severe brain damage or they can even die. These babies normal at birth, they don't have symptoms, and if you don't do this blood test and detect the biochemical problem that they have before the symptoms start to occur, these symptoms can be irreversible and they can be devastating. In 1962, Oregon became the first state to adopt statewide PKU screening, and as was just mentioned, prior to that time, when we began universal screening of all babies for phenylketonuria, about 1% of all the admissions to Fairview Training Center were because of undiagnosed, untreated PKU. And since that screening began, there was never another such admission. We caught them all, and we treated them all, and we prevented disease in every one of those children. We're very, very proud of that. The treatment, as you know now, involves specialized testing and ongoing dietary monitoring, plus the medical foods that you just heard described. For the last 40 years, we've been doing this in our laboratory in partnership with OHSU, and my colleagues from OHSU are going to talk in just a moment. This requires not only the early detection through a lab test that's administered on a few drops of blood collected from the baby at birth, but also the follow-up and the necessary clinical intervention for these kids. We've so far screened about 1.5 million Oregon infants, and we've identified over 600 of them that have one kind of metabolic disorder or another that needs treatment. I'll just mention that in addition, we have a regional program. We screen not only Oregon babies, but also all the babies born in Alaska, Idaho, Nevada, and Hawaii. So this is a very successful program. Today, for Oregon babies, we've recently increased the number of disorders we screen for to 26, one of which is PKU, and that's the result of House Bill 2268, which you folks passed in the last legislative session that authorized us to do that. This has been a big success. The technology is working, we're finding kids, and we're preventing illness. I'll just say that it's really critically important that when we identify one of these children by screening, they have to get prompt and effective treatment. And there's really little use in our program even detecting these disorders at birth if we can't assure that infants are going to get the necessary treatment. And that would include, of course, all the medical care that they need, but also the nutritional monitoring and the medical foods that you've heard described. So we urge you to continue this insurance coverage and pass House Bill 74, excuse me, Senate Bill 74.
Mike, how many PKU babies have been identified. Do you have a number on that out of the 600?
PKU occurs, Representative Cruz, in about 1 in 10,000 births, and we have 45,000 births a year in Oregon. And so if you do the arithmetic, you can see that we're finding 4 or 5 of these children a year. That's just for PKU, and that's just in Oregon. But overall, for all the disorders, we find about 1 in every 1,500 to 2,000 births. So we're finding 25 or 30, roughly 1 every 2 weeks.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Kerry Harding. I'm assistant professor of pediatrics and molecular genetics at OHSU, and I'm one of the attending physicians that treats these children. I'm going to actually not give you much detail on the therapy because our nutritionist, Kathleen Huntington, is the expert on this, but I'll follow up on your question, Representative Cruz. We currently treat over 200 people in our clinic of all ages, specifically for PKU. We see about 1,000 people per year, however, with all different types of metabolic disorders. Not all of them have dietary therapy, so it's probably a fourth of those that are currently being treated. And we will, on average, probably add 10 a year or so, given the birth rate in Oregon, to that list that presumably will require dietary therapy for life. The Senate Bill 74 is the natural extension of the newborn screening law that was passed last year. It totally enables us to be able to treat these children effectively, and there's really no reason to screen for them if we cannot make sure that we can guarantee a healthy outcome for them.
Okay. Thank you. Please.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Huntington. I'm a medical nutritional therapist, and I've been working up at OHSU in the metabolic clinic for 16 years. What I want to show on my PowerPoint presentation here is to give you some background information so you understand why medical foods are absolutely necessary to treat these types of disorders. It's not on. It's not on. I can flip it back and flip it forward, but
call me.
You know, I think you guys have this, so I could just go over that with you. Third one down, I want to point out that the reasons it's a good idea to support the extension of the medical foods law is that it equalizes access to the medical treatment for all socioeconomic groups. I'll explain why that's very important, because they're very expensive, and obviously the only most well, the higher income people are really the only people that can afford this kind of treatment. And then it increases the potential for optimal outcome, because it really since it equalizes access, these people will use the treatment so that they can best prevent the serious clinical outcomes if they weren't treated. And then it saves Oregon dollars in the way of special education costs and health care costs. So what I want to explain to you is what is a genetic metabolic disease, why medical foods are necessary to treat these disorders, and why the legislation is needed.
Just a second, Representative Dalton, you had a question.
Yeah, I just had a brief question before we sort of get into this. You know, Katie testified that she gets her, I guess, the powder.
Yes.
From Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Yes.
Do the patients, I guess, have to go up to the university to get it, or does she get through the mail, or are you able to distribute that?
We distribute from the center and send it out UPS all over the state. Everybody with PKU comes up to our center. They're referred in from primary care physicians because they don't want to deal with this disorder. They don't have the clinical expertise. And so we just send it out. They order it. And that way we can monitor it, which is really important to do, to make sure it's done.
It works well as to get it?
Yes. Many years ago, the Department of Public Health transferred the responsibility of the distribution of the medical formula to the families because it became apparent that the population was growing and it was becoming unwieldy to deal with this. And since we were the medical consultants, we also were referred in with all these patients, so we took care of them and started distributing the medical food that way.
Thank you.
Hey, would it be safe to assume this is the Medicaid-covered
disorder? Yes.
Okay.
Chairman Cruz, it's clearly Medicaid covered, and in fact, during the last legislation, Medicaid was very supportive of this from our department. OMAP was.
On page 2, I'll drop down to the picture of the dietary specialties product. That's a label that's on the medical foods. To be used solely under medical supervision, the dietary management of conditions which require control restriction of protein intake. The problem all started in the 1970s because the FDA pulled back the necessity of having to have medical foods go through FDA review and approval because they wanted to open the market and increase R&D for these products. Well, as a result, they were no longer pharmaceuticals, and the insurance company stopped paying for them. And this is the only treatment for PKU and many of the other disorders that we medically manage. And so it became a catch-22. Here we are trying to help people access these foods that were for medical treatment, but yet they were so expensive nobody could use them or access them. So page 3, look down on the nutritional requirements for protein tolerance due to PKU. Typically, let's take just the regular person with PKU. They can only tolerate 5 grams of natural protein per day. But an 8-year-old needs about 28 grams on paper and 1,900 calories. Well, the next slide shows you that what 5 grams of natural protein looks like. It's 2 tablespoons of cooked spaghetti, 1/3 cup tomato sauce, 1/4 cup cooked broccoli, 1/3 slice of regular bread, 1/2 cup of tossed lettuce, and 3/4 of a regular orange. Well, if any of you have children, you know that for an 8-year-old, that is not enough food to sustain that little person. And that only provides 165 calories. So what you need is the medical food, which is the next slide. It provides 1,735 calories. 410 comes from medical beverage and another 1,300 from low-protein substitute products. This is what sustains the children. The natural foods are supplementary. They're recreational. And the medical food is the only way that they are alive, actually. They can live.
Mr. Chairman, what is in this? The medical food.
The medical food is made up of, the medical beverage. That is a high-protein drink, but it has no phenylalanine in the case of PKU medical beverage. If in the case of homocystinuria, it has no methionine. It allows the provision of adequate protein without the offending amino acid. And so that's why you can treat it. Phenylalanine, you have to have it. It's an essential amino acid. And so in order to treat it, you restrict it. And so that's the magic of it. And so the rest of the medical beverage is consisting of vitamins and minerals and fat and carbohydrate so that you get calories. Because if you don't get calories, you break down muscle tissue and you end up with a high phenylalanine level. Because your body's breaking down muscle tissue to get the energy.
Okay.
So, page 4, what are the costs for state services if you don't treat these kinds of disorders? Well, $6,300 per year for special education. And once the person goes to a supervised health care facility, if a family can no longer take care of them, it's $3,000 to $5,000 per month. So the next slide shows that the cost per year for PKU for different age groups is far less than the special education costs per year. And if you go down to the next slide, you'll see that over the lifespan of somebody for 30 years for PKU, if they weren't treated, it would cost the state $580,000 in costs, and then also, and then only 200, well, not only, but $215,000 for medical food over a 30-year time period. So you get... The next slide is this picture of this unfortunate individual who was not treated for his metabolic disease. But the next two children, individuals, a young baby who was just recently diagnosed, and we have another little patient right there who has PKU, and then a young man who just started college this year at Harvey Mudd Engineering School in California, and it's all because he was treated for PKU that he was even able to go to college. And that's basically, if we're going to screen for these disorders, we better make sure we treat them.
Questions? Thank you all very much. And now we've solved our slide problem, haven't we?
Have we?
Joanne, Michelle, and Jennifer. Good morning.
Good morning.
However you want to do it.
Chair Cruz, my name is Michelle, and these are my pride and joy. This picture is a picture of two brothers who love each other, and for the last 21 months have been experiencing many first adventures together. Thank God I do live in the age where we have the medical technology that we do, we have the medical knowledge that we have. And my youngest, who has PKU, Seth, is treated. He lives like any other little boy his age. When I put my friend's kids and his kid, you know, him together, only difference is his snacks. I want to keep it that way. I look forward to these two boys sharing so many more adventures in their life, so many more first things. They're my life, my love. Like nothing. They're incredible. Incredible. I'm just here to support everybody else and asking you for your support. Making sure these adventures happen for them. I want to see my boys go to college. I want to see them play sports. I want to see them do anything and everything they ever want to do. And that'll happen with the medical foods. I'm not worried about that. We have you. And they have me. Together, it's a pretty good team. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What are your son's names?
This is Matthew, and this is Keikoa Seth.
How old's Matthew?
Matthew is 13. He doesn't have PKU. Seth, he does.
Thank you.
Please.
Hi. My name is Jennifer Jones, and I am 27 years old. I am a behavioral therapist for children with autism. I'm a wife, a leader in my church, a voter, and a taxpayer. I also have a metabolic disorder called phenylketonuria, also known as PKU, which you've all heard about a few times today. I was diagnosed at birth and placed on a treatment plan since there's no cure for PKU. The treatment plan is to maintain a low phenylalanine diet using the medical foods to keep phenylalanine levels at a safe range. Without the treatment, the phenylalanine becomes a toxin of the body, which poisons the central nervous system and the brain. This leads to physical breakdown of the body as well as severe mental retardation. Because I was placed under treatment at birth, I developed normally and stayed within age-appropriate developmental stages. My childhood and teen years were both full and active. I achieved average to above average grades. I was very involved in sports, church, drama, music, and had many wonderful friendships. More recently in my adult life, I found myself without insurance, and I was unable to afford the treatment for a few years. At that time, I attempted to maintain the low phenylalanine levels without using these medical foods. It was impossible, and my phenylalanine levels began, they reached an unhealthy range, and I felt the effects of it. I began experiencing extreme skin sensitivity, chronic and debilitating migraines, nausea, muscle pain, exhaustion, emotional fragility, and losses in the areas of attention span and short-term memory. I have since become insured, thank goodness, and resumed treatment using the medical foods, and have consistently had safe phenylalanine levels for just over a year now. All of my symptoms have decreased, and most have disappeared completely. I am again able to live a full and active life. The state currently mandates newborn screening for these disorders, and it only makes sense that you would also continue to mandate the treatment for them. So I'm asking you to please support the House bill, or the Senate bill 74. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I'm the State Director of Program Services for the March of Dimes. I'm here on behalf of the March of Dimes to ask your support of Senate Bill 74. I'm not going to read my testimony, and we've gone over all of the issues here, and I just wanted to let you know that our organization funded much of the research that resulted in the development of many of the earliest newborn screening tests. We are very much in support of Senate Bill 74, and there are so many birth defects that have no treatment, and medical foods for treating disorders like PKU and some of the other metabolic disorders are truly a success story. And the March of Dimes urges you to support this bill, and on behalf of the March of Dimes, I want to thank you for letting us testify before you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Peggy.
Good morning, Representative Cruz and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I'm not here to oppose the PKU mandate. I'm here, I believe that it should be continued. However, I do believe that the six-year sunset review should be applied to this requirement, to this proposal. As I've routinely testified in the committee, I continue to believe that we need to periodically review existing mandates and to reassess the review of new proposals. This is especially important when you look at mandated requirements that depend upon a specific type of treatment for a specific condition. Treatments and technologies change, and over time, a different type of treatment may become appropriate for a particular condition. And looking into, in fact, the March of Dimes website, they cite research into not only genetic research, but also synthetic enzymes as being a possibility for a treatment. And as with this and other complicated types of conditions, I think, as I said, it's appropriate to periodically review these. And the reason for it is that I've distributed a list of the mandates that are being considered this session. Two have been, this is the second one considered in this committee. The other one required a reauthorization of reimbursement for emergency room services. That bill actually contains a six-year review and recently passed out of the Senate committee. I'm also a believer that we really need to be sensitive, as this committee well knows, of the cost of health insurance. And I also distributed another set of tables that shows an approximation of what private health insurance is costing us today, that private health insurance that is the subject of mandate proposals. And it looks like we're spending approximately $4.4 billion on health insurance. If we have just 1% increase as a result of new mandates, we're talking about $44 million per year. We're taking a look at current trends that are in the area of 15%, which would generate over $500 million in additional costs. This is just to provide the sort of context for the discussion, and I hope that during the interim we can take a look at how we review mandates, take a look at those that warrant periodically reviews, some may be put aside. But in any event, I think when we take a look at the difficulties we're facing with health care costs, not only in the Oregon Health Plan, but also in the private insurance sector, we really do need to be very serious about establishing a process where we are clear in what we're requiring and have an understanding of what the cost consequences are. So with that, I would answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair, a question?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Peggy, I'm assuming these are Oregon figures?
Yes, they are.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. On the committee, in the full understanding, I'm absolutely supportive of this bill and wanting to move it. I think there's some efficacy to the review. I have talked to Senator Courtney and his staff about it. They have no problem with adding that back in. It was taken out, and so I would propose that we bring this back when it's amended so that the 6-year review takes place. I think it's appropriate that we review things on a periodic basis that we are mandating, and that does not mean that we aren't supportive, because we are supportive, but process needs to be handled in an appropriate way, and I think reviewing is an appropriate process. So we will make the appropriate amendment to the bill and bring it back and pass it. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dalto.
Do we have a sense of how long that might take so the folks in the audience could sort of follow along?
It's fairly simple, isn't it? I would think we'd be able to do it this week. If not, maybe not Wednesday, but certainly by Friday we should be able to have it and pass it. So
we need to have an amendment drafted by the Legislative Council, and as soon as we get that amendment drafted to take into consideration, we will bring the bill back up and try to pass it.
No, we won't try to pass it. We will pass it.
Even better.
You have no choice on this one. So thank you all very much. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 74. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 192 modifies the membership of local public safety coordinating councils. It requires that membership include both a health director and a mental health director. This is a housekeeping type of bill, and we have the agency here to speak to it.
Madeline, in 25 words or less.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Keeping in mind, I think this bill passes, so it's probably not controversial. Please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Madeline Olson. I'm the Assistant Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I'm here this morning in support of Senate Bill 192. As you noted, it's simply a housekeeping measure that assures at the local level and the local public safety coordinating councils the aspects of mental illness as they relate to law enforcement can be kept in mind and planned for so that there can be increasingly tighter work between mental health and local law enforcement, and I would appreciate your support.
Any questions? Very straightforward, very simple bill. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Open a work session on Senate Bill 192. Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dalto moves Senate Bill 192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 192 to the consent calendar.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 192 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 192, having received the required majority, is passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 192. And anything else? Not to your knowledge or mine either. We are adjourned.